Welcome back, everyone, to this Fashion Law Dinner Party. Our party theme of digital fashion is still going strong. In this second part, we'll continue our exploration of digital fashion and delve deeper into the legal questions and nuances that digital fashion is raising. We're increasingly seeing born digital fashion, fashion that is produced especially for our online lives and the online versions of ourselves. We're also increasingly seeing AI used to create fashion, or at the very least, to manage supply chains and create compelling marketing campaigns. But as fashion embraces the digital world, clothing becomes intangible. And so, therefore, do the goods to which we affix a sign like a trademark, a sign that is supposed to signal the producer or sponsor of the fashion we're buying to help us make purchases on the market. In other words, as we enter the intangible space, the divide between the messages and meanings that trademarks signal when they are on physical clothing and when trademarks are on intangible clothing seems to become blurry. What do we as consumers care about, for example, when we see a Nike swoosh embodied in a digital bag or a digital shoe? Do we think that that Nike swoosh indicates that Nike produced that digital bag? Or might we be more inclined to see that Nike swoosh digital bag as part of a digital expression, especially if that digital shoe is made by an artist? These questions about the relationship between expression and trademarks are not new. You might have visited, for example, the Museum of Modern Art and seen Warhol's use of the Campbell's Soup logo in his celebrated Campbell's Soup Can series. But today, uses of fashion brands' trademarks in the digital space by artists and by the brands who own these trademarks themselves are increasingly raising issues about the boundaries we should draw around the sort of meanings and messages that trademark law cares about. Should a fashion brand be able to stop an artist from using their trademark, especially if that artist sells their work on the market through a digital platform? If a fashion brand can stop this artist, how should they? What factors should we take into account? Are fashion brands effectively co-opting all meanings embodied in a trademark beyond the message that the fashion brand might have produced the goods when fashion brands enter the digital space and enforce their trademark rights? And what is a trademark use anyway? When is a logo used as a trademark and when is it not? These are complicated and big questions. So to help me untangle them, I turned to Professor Mark McKenna, a professor of law at UCLA and author of many articles on trademarks, including one called Trademarks and Digital Goods, and one of the co-founders of the law firm Lex Lumina. Hi, Mark. Thank you so much for speaking with me today. I'm really excited to talk to you about trademark, other IP, legal rights, digital fashion heritage. This will be great. Thank you so much.
Yeah, happy to be here.
So I think I'll start out a little bit with, you know, some of the examples of the digital fashion that we've seen recently in the fashion industry, as it were. So, you know, for example, a Bitmoji avatar on Snapchat can now wear Valentino, as can your Meta avatar. But luxury brands have continued to also create NFTs attached to digital clothes and works of authorship like films or even digital paintings. And designers have also taken the digital to the tangible product, as it were, incorporating images or even born digital NFTs and avatars into their physical garments. So there's a lot going on here from the tangible, intangible property divide. And as you know, we've spoken about before, as lawyers, we like to categorize. So as a leading IP scholar and attorney, you know, how do you categorize these types of new activities into IP boxes, so to speak?
Yeah. I mean, I think you're right that everything is changing really fast here. I mean, I think a year and a half ago, like when the Tarantino case was first started getting litigated, I was getting calls every single week wanting me to come and talk about NFTs, right? And then the NFT market went in the tank. And so nobody really wants to talk about NFTs anymore. But in the meantime, you know, obviously all the sort of technology and the capabilities are evolving, you know? And I think one of the things, at the beginning of this sort of discussion of NFTs, it felt a lot to me like when the domain name system first rolled out. It felt like it was kind of a gold rush period where people were trying to kind of plant flags and claim rights in ways where they were expecting there to be value. But, you know, and in the same way, when we saw the internet rolling out, I think there was like, when I'm old enough that I was in law school in the .com era, where people would say they were going to start a .com, and you would say, well, like, what's that .com going to do? And they were like, oh, it doesn't matter. It's a .com, right? So .coms just print money. And I think there was a sense of that in the beginning of the sort of digital stuff too. It was like NFTs are just going to print money, and all these digital uses are going to be like, you know, and my strong sense then was some would prove to be interesting and valuable, most would not, but that it would take a while for us to know kind of which were which, right? So, you know, I think every time there's a new capability or there's a new technology or a new business model, all law, but especially IP law, what everybody tries to do the best they can is think about what the right analogies are, right? And think about, what do we know already and that we already have sort of settled legal rules about, and how is this similar to or different from it? Sometimes when it's new technology stuff, there's a strong sense, especially I think among judges, that like the technology is magic, you know? And so at the beginning of the internet, when you would read these cases, there would be these paragraphs that I always joke with my students about where that I think were just like, you know, they were just like F8 copy and, you know, paste into the decisions, where there would be like the judges, you could tell, trying to teach themselves the internet. You know, they'd be like, the internet is a series of computers that are connected, you know, things that now look funny. And like, if you teach those cases now, it looks hilarious. But at the time, they were just like, this is this magical thing that doesn't exist, you know, hadn't existed before. Sometimes when things feel magical, they sort of necessarily feel radically different, right, from things that we've known before. And usually when law, usually, not always, but usually when law or IP treats things as kind of radically different, it turns out to be wrong, right? It turns out to be that there are more analogies than there are. And so I think that was the same sort of thing with a lot of these digital things, right? So like some of the digital uses or maybe even like, especially the NFT stuff at the beginning, struck me like the best analogy was certificates of authenticity, right? That what these things were doing was like, just like when you get a signed numbered print or you get a certificate of authenticity, it was like, it was not itself the product. It was like doing some sort of, you know, authentication kind of work. And that meant that I felt like a lot of the mental energy at the beginning of the NFT stuff was like, I think even just explaining to people what NFTs were, because in common parlance, people have a very strong tendency to conflate the NFT, which is just a digital token, with whatever it's pointing to or with whatever it's attached to. And then the magic would come in and say, well, it's an NFT, and not realizing that actually like the thing that has the value here is the thing the NFT is pointing to. And we should ask kind of what that is, or what it, you know, what it sort of looks like. And so some of those NFTs look to me very much like the kinds of stuff that are, when they are statements about authenticity, that we would ordinarily police with like false advertising type law, right? We would say, if what people care about here is a statement that this comes from a particular person, or that it's a limited number, those are statements that are true or false, right? And so those are the kinds of things that we could easily kind of, with existing rules about like, you can't materially mislead people about things they care about, and false advertising law would kind of do the work there. I think when it got harder was when people were trying to use what to my eye looked like legal rules that were meant for very different kinds of settings, just because it was the same companies or the same entities that also make real world sort of components, right? So when you start by saying an avatar can wear Valentino, the first question I was like, what does that even mean, that an avatar can wear Valentino? I think what you mean is an avatar can have an image that looks like a real world Valentino thing, but is not, right? Because it's not a physical thing. It doesn't have any of the thread count. It doesn't have any of the characteristics. It doesn't have any of the, you know, the way that the thing is made or who it's made by. It's really just an image, right, of something. And so that's very much like asking, does the fact that you have trademark rights in relation to the sale of the real thing in the world mean you get to control images of it, right? And if we thought, well, what we're talking about here is a video game or a movie, the answer to that would be obviously no, right? That you can't, you can't use trademark law to protect against depictions of real world things. And so then the right question to me seems like, is there some way in which these uses are meaningfully different from those, right? If these are just virtual reproductions, that means basically it's a picture of something. And if people care that it is actually from Valentino, that seems to me like the sort of thing that's a certificate of authenticity kind of point, right? Which is the fact that the avatar is wearing something that looks like Valentino is different from the question of whether people think that whatever they got from Valentino, right? And so the tricky part, I think, was going to always be trying to figure out exactly what the legal rules were to divide the two of those things. But it seemed to me that immediately going to the position of, because I can sell real world versions of this, I can control all virtual reproductions of it, was going to very strongly conflict with most of the other rules we have about artistic representation of other stuff. Now, of course, like then Jack Daniels happened. And so maybe the rules are all kind of up in the air on that stuff now too, anyway.
So that brings me to two follow-up questions. The first is, you know, does that analysis of yours with the image of Valentino, you know, on the avatar change if Valentino has a trademark for, let's say, their V or the word Valentino as applied to digital goods, as many brands now are receiving? And also, does it change if instead of just, you know, seeing the image and dressing your avatar, you actually pay something, which now, you know, people are doing, for example, to dress their avatars, although I would say that the price is much more, we might say, reasonable in the metaverse, $2.99 to $5.99. So number one. But then number two, you know, on that point about Jack Daniels, could you tell us a little bit more about that case and how you see it as relevant in the digital world? Because of course there we were talking about a tangible, you know, bottle of Jack Daniels with, okay, a mark obviously on the tangible good, and a tangible squeaky toy with a mark on a tangible good.
So the first question you asked was basically about, does it make a difference if somebody has trademark rights in or has a registration for a mark in relation to digital goods? And so I'll just go all full cards on the table. Like, this is probably the most controversial thing I'll say today, which is that I don't think there's such a thing as digital goods. Like, I think goods are, in the way we've always understood them in the trademark world, they're physical things. I think that's what the Daystar case says, is that trademarks relate to the characteristics of tangible goods. And the reason that's true is because the information that trademarks are giving you has something to do with the sort of tangible characteristics of the goods, right? That's the kind of information it's giving you. It's you know, we talk about source indication, but really source is a sort of proxy for a bunch of other information about the nature of the goods themselves, right? And digital goods have no nature like that. They have there's no sense in which a digital handbag has any characteristics of itself as a handbag, right? It has digital characteristics, but there's no reason in the world to think those digital characteristics have anything to do with someone's ability to make tennis shoes or something like that, right? It's more like those are the pixelated, you know, versions of, so it's sort of like saying, this is just a picture of a thing and you don't have trademark rights in pictures of things, right? Like, you don't have trademark rights when Warhol paints the Campbell's soup cans. Like, we wouldn't call those, you know, Campbell's has trademark rights in, I don't even know what you would call those, right? Like, two-dimensional representations of the soup cans. So, you know, I'm sure what I just said will get a lot of folks riled up, but I think, like, reasoning from basic principles of trademark law, there is no such thing as digital goods. And so therefore, trademark rights in relation to digital goods is just a nonsense statement, I think. Like, I think it's a, now I recognize that the trademark office is registering a whole bunch of these things, but that doesn't persuade me that what they're doing makes any sense as a matter of trademark law. Now, let me distinguish that from something, though, that I think is absolutely legitimate kind of trademark use, which is if somebody cares that they're getting whatever that image is, right, the digital $2.99 Valentino thing, they care that they're getting it from Valentino, certainly trademark law should police the authenticity of the seller of that thing, right? So if somebody thinks they're on Valentino's site or they're in a world where there's a store being sponsored by Valentino and it matters to them that they get it from that, certainly that would be legitimately using trademark law. But that's, I think, in the spirit of what I was saying about false advertising, right? You don't get to put a sign up on your store and say, we're Valentino, if you're not. But if you're pretty transparent, you're like, we're just a place selling digital images that happen to look like others. Then that's like, that's not about authenticity in the sense of like telling you who you got it from. It's more like, we want to control all visual representation of this object. And like, and so I think there's a pretty strong distinction between the two of those. I think it's also kind of ironic that, like, you know, if we think that what trademarks are doing is supposed to guarantee you something about provenance, that it's sort of ironic that we would imagine transmitting that kind of legal rule into a digital world where all the information about provenance can be carried in the token along with the image, right? It's like the place where we need trademark law the least, because the reason we use it when somebody buys a pair of physical shoes is that we're relying on the sort of the markings on the shoes to tell us who made them, because we don't really have another way to do that, right? There's no other, but like in the digital world, like that information can all travel. So if it makes a difference to you, like, is that little avatar wearing a real, Valentino thing? Like the token can carry that information. So I think this is like, it's calling on trademark law to be copyright law is what it is. And I think that's an illegitimate move that we ought to resist, even while we recognize that like there are some people who might care about where they get things, and there should be like a strong form version of kind of false advertising regulation here.
One of the things that intrigues me the most is this relationship between copyright and trademark law that you identified. I mean, we are talking about digital fashion here, but obviously we also have this concept of fashion heritage, meaning past products that are increasingly being, you know, digitized, at least to be accessible, like you would think in an online database, publicly, or even just digitized to be shown as part of, you know, window displays, for example. And so you have this notion of, you know, I really like the way you talk about images, because in many ways, you're just creating images of fashion from the past within a brand universe. But going to what you said about source, this helps to tell consumers something about the product. So one of the questions I would have, especially given that you mentioned Daystar and also Jack Daniels, I mean, what could you tell us a little bit more about this notion of source and how it is that, you know, it frames our recognition of what matters or what should matter about a digital good, and why the divide between trademark and copyright here, especially as we go digital, is so important.
So I think I'll start with Rogers, right? Which is the Jack Daniels case is Jack Daniels suing a company called VIP. The VIP makes tangible dog toys, right? Squeaky dog toys, a lot of which are made to resemble real world products. So in this case, made to resemble the Jack Daniels whiskey bottle. Mm-hmm. They called it Bad Spaniels rather than Jack Daniels. And there was like a joke on there about how, you know, the dogs go number two, and there's a reference to that. So it's meant to be sort of a parodic toy, but it's in the shape of a bottle of Jack Daniels, which, you know, Justice Kagan depicts in the opinion. And it's got, you know, the label that sort of, you know, visually resembles, but uses slightly different words. So there's a longstanding, since the 80s, legal doctrine that arose out of a case where Ginger Rogers sued the producers of a Fellini film, called Ginger and Fred, where, the movie was about a fictional character. It was not biographical. It was a fictional character who aspired to be a professional dancer, and so aspired to be like Ginger Rogers. And so the story follows her through through this journey to try to be professional dancers. So Ginger Rogers sued. A couple of important facts about that. Ginger Rogers had actually licensed use of her name to several other movies. So she had, and then she had survey evidence in the case that showed that something like 38% of people thought that she had something to do with the movie, and some smaller percentage, I want to say 14 or 15, thought she actually she produced it or she was in it. So she had, by trademark standards, quite strong survey evidence that people were confused about her involvement with the movie. The Second Circuit said, though, but you know, but it's a movie, like, and so giving somebody the ability to control the naming of a movie is like giving them control over the content of a movie, and that's expressive, speech that deserves First Amendment protection. That's not quite the same as what happens when somebody's advertising a product, right? So, though it's unclear what the status of commercial speech doctrine is in the Supreme Court right now. The one way of explaining kind of the longstanding rule was that commercial speech was speech that where you were using the speech to sell some other product. Non-commercial speech was where the speech itself was the product, right? So when you're selling a movie, what people are buying is the movie, right? They're buying the speech, as opposed to like an advertisement for Anheuser-Busch that runs that might be entertaining, but is ultimately directed at selling beer, right? And so that would be the sort of distinction. And the Second Circuit said, when you're making a movie, it's like non-commercial speech. That's not the wheelhouse of trademark law. So the trademark interests are weaker there and the speech interests are greater. And the rule that it devised was that as long as the use of the trademark, in this case, the use of the trademark in the title, Ginger and Fred, was artistically relevant and was not explicitly misleading. And just to emphasize, the way the court actually phrased the artistic relevance set is that as long as it had any artistic relevance whatsoever, right, and that it wasn't explicitly misleading, then there couldn't be a Lanham Act claim. So it was like a kind of constitutional avoidance doctrine, basically saying we're going to have a backstop here that if it's explicitly misleading, if they were to say something like officially sponsored by Ginger Rogers, you could have a claim for that, but you couldn't have a claim for kind of implicit statements, right? Where people sort of just inferred from the title that she was sponsoring it, even though the survey evidence suggested a lot of people did make that inference, right? And the court, Second Circuit said that inference is not enough to overcome the First Amendment interest. And so the way the Second Circuit framed that was the Rogers Doctrine applied to what it called expressive works. And one challenge has always been since then is like, what is that category? Like, what does it mean to say something's an expressive work? How does that correspond to commercial speech doctrine? The basic principles of Rogers versus Grimaldi were then over time adopted by every circuit that answered the question. Not every single circuit had a case where they had addressed it, but all the ones that had and had decided the question had adopted Rogers. The probably strongest form version of it was adopted by the Ninth Circuit. The Ninth Circuit has a series of cases that basically say artistic relevance just means more than zero, right? And that explicitly misleading means explicitly, like it's not enough that you show confusion through a survey. You have to show like a statement that is in the form of like officially sponsored by or, you know. So that was the kind of strongest form. But the way that it especially kind of had started to expand, this is where the Jack Daniels case comes in, was in trying to figure out what the boundaries of that doctrine were, like what counted as an expressive work. So in the early days of the Rogers test, all of the cases were about movies and songs and books and things that people might sort of conventionally recognize as like core First Amendment kind of things. More recently, there's been a lot of video game cases. There've been other cases there's one case in the Ninth Circuit about greeting cards. That case was kind of messed up, but But the Jack Daniels case was like, they extended Rogers to this dog toy, right? And the theory of extending it was, even though it's a toy, it's a physical thing, unlike a movie, the mm-hmm. thing that people are really buying is the expression, it's the joke, right? So it's like, which I would call it sort of like a hybrid. So in this respect, I think the case was hard, right? Because I think if you think conventional commercial speech doctrine would say, non-commercial speech is when you're buying expression. If you're buying a movie, there's kind of unequivocal that the only thing you're buying is expression, right? Like unless it's a very unusual movie, like you're getting the movie.
Right.
In this case though, like you're getting a dog toy, right? And so the question of sort of the framing is, am I getting a dog toy where the joke is a bonus, or am I getting a joke that only makes sense because it's a dog toy, right? And so that question felt to me like always like the hardest part, but I don't think it was unreasonable to say that a lot of what was being sold here was the speech, even if like I think that was less obvious. Jack Daniels folks and INTA tried to get the Supreme Court to take this case several times. They went they lost at the Ninth Circuit. They asked for en banc. They lost that. They went tried to get rehearing. They lost that. They got the initial cert petition. Rebecca Tushnet and I wrote an amicus brief opposing cert, which normally you don't do because usually if you don't want them to take cert, you don't want to draw attention to the case and make it seem like it's worth paying attention to. But we were like, I think this is a really bad vehicle for this. And so they didn't take it the first time. And then they took it the second time. The pitch that was made by Jack Daniels to the Supreme, well, the pitch originated by INTA and originally made in the Ninth Circuit was Rogers shouldn't apply to ordinary commercial products. Now, of course, query, what's an ordinary commercial product? Video games are a huge business, right? So are those ordinary commercial products? That was originally the pitch, basically like Rogers should stay, but should stay in its lane. It shouldn't be ordinary commercial products. That's not the pitch that Jack Daniels actually made at the Supreme Court. They basically said, throw out Rogers altogether, right? Rogers just shouldn't have any application. When there are trademark rights win. In fact, there's a sentence in Jack Daniels' brief that I thought blew my mind because it was like 1L con law all over again. And they were like, the Constitution can't override statutes. And I was like, No, that's not the Supremacy Clause. The Supremacy Clause runs exactly the opposite way of that. So the Supreme Court did something funny, which is, I can only read as a sort of compromise. In a 6-3 decision, well, I guess it's unanimous, but there's three judges who appear quite ready to throw out Rogers altogether, three justices. But Kagan holds together the court by basically saying, getting six people, well, I guess all nine, but like, you know, really six to sign on to this idea that whatever Rogers' application is in other cases, it doesn't apply in cases where the court says the defendant is making a trademark use of the term. So one of the reasons that a lot of people who do what I do head exploded about that is that about 15 years ago, there was a whole series of cases, trademark cases, involving keyword advertising, where Google was selling, for example, they would sell to Hertz the right to have its ads triggered in response to searches about Avis. So the question was like, can somebody buy keyword search results using somebody else's trademark? Google's position in all those cases was, we're not making trademark use of the word Avis. We are just letting people do a search on that. That's like an internal use. We're not branding our own products. And they kind of got a little traction with that, but a lot of courts were kind of not sure what to do with it, in part because it was like really unclear what the relationship between trademark use and likelihood of confusion was. In fact, there was like a whole series of academic articles, one of which I wrote, that was basically like, the problem with the idea of trademark use being a threshold thing is that no one could tell you with any certainty what a trademark use is. And they especially can't tell you what it is without collapsing into likelihood of confusion language. And the reason for that is because we've sort of over time increasingly defined trademark use as like anything that indicates source. And so that sort of sounds like anything that tells you something about source is causing confusion. And so the Supreme Court evokes this idea. It doesn't apply when it's a trademark use, by the way, an argument not made by anybody in the case, not briefed, not argued. And if they had, of course, called for briefing on this, there might've been briefing on like why this was either a bad idea, or at least they needed to say a lot more about what a trademark use is if they're going to go that way. But they didn't, in part because this case seemed sort of easy in that respect, because VIP admitted that it was using this as a trademark and said they claimed trademark rights in Bad Spaniels. So it didn't present any of the difficult problems, right? So the Supreme Court says in the Rogers case itself, Ginger and Fred, nobody's using it as a trademark. It's purely expressive. But that's not at all true. In fact, the plaintiff in that case said, no, the reason that we know that that you're using it as a trademark is because there's all this confusion, and we have a survey that shows it. So, and the Second Circuit described it as a hybrid use that was partly source indicating and partly. So the Supreme Court was just disingenuous or wrong in the way that it described all those other cases. And it just says, so in cases where it's not purely expressive, it's a trademark use, Rogers doesn't apply. So that's like the step zero thing. trademark law is full of these things that are like these threshold questions, right? Like, ask this, and then that determines which way you go. So in the trade dress context, you have to first ask, is it product configuration or is it product design, product packaging? So now what the Supreme Court has done is set up and said basically the first question in any putative Rogers case is like, is it a trademark use or not? And that would be fine if we knew what a trademark use was and we could easily sort. And this court says some things about that. It says, you know, a trademark is like tells people who's responsible for the goods. It tells, you know, it gives some information about who's putting it out, but it doesn't really wrestle with all of the complexity of what source means in modern trademark law. So it has language that I think suggests that it has in mind kind of the core idea of trademark use, which is like the swoosh on the side of the shoe tells people that Nike or somebody who works for Nike produced this physical thing, right? But that's actually not the argument that Jack Daniels was making in the case. They were not saying people think we made this. They were saying people will think that we are somehow affiliated with it because it looks like ours. So that's the challenge of that case, is that it basically says Rogers only applies when it's a non-trademark use. The reason that I think you started talking about all that is like, I think in all the digital context, the question is going to be like, are these trademark uses or not, right? So the case, I think you know something about this, the Meta Birkins case, right? Hermes sued an artist named Mason Rothschild, which I said full disclosure, my firm represents Mason Rothschild in the case. But he produced digital images of Birkin bags that are fanciful images that look like fur-covered things. Some of them have like, you know, other kinds of imagery on them. But they're digital images, and, you know, they obviously reference Birkin bags. Rothschild's position has always been they reference Birkin bags in the same way that Warhol's Campbell's soup cans reference Campbell's soup, but they aren't Birkin bags. They're pictures of Birkin bags, and that, you know, the law is really different about depictions of things than it is like the real things. And so, you know, his position in that case has always been, this is a Rogers case, right? These are digital images that are fully deserving of First Amendment protection. And the fact that he's calling them Meta Birkins is just like calling a film about a character who wants to be Ginger Rogers, Ginger and Fred. But now, of course, it means after Jack Daniels, the threshold filter question there is, was this a trademark use or not? And now, you know, we're going to have to litigate over that question in the sort of shadow of Jack Daniels. And I kind of expect that in a lot of these digital use cases, this trademark use question is going to have to filter around for a while, because, although I think there are obviously things to say about that, I think the most recent Second Circuit opinion that came out in the Vans versus Mischief case just last week doesn't bode well in terms of the depth of analysis of trademark use. The court's analysis, I think, in that case is quite shallow. And I think, you know, this is a big question we're going to face in lots of these contexts.
Yes. I mean, one example that comes to mind as you were talking in the fashion space, which, you know, wasn't litigated, but that goes to all these different points between expressive, commercial, source indicating, non-source indicating, artist versus, you know, brand, is the real Gucci line that Alessandro Michele, Gucci's former creative director, created with the artist Andrew Trouble, which, you know, Amy Adler and Jeannie Fromer have also talked about in their taking intellectual property in their own hands article, but which it goes so much to your points, because on these bags, you have, you know, real graffitied with the word Gucci. And, you know, let's set aside that this is a collab that a brand has done with an artist. Let's just say that I decided to, you know, buy a Gucci bag and spray paint real on it and then go around with it, or, you know, sell it myself. I mean, the question is when you see that word Gucci, you know, are you thinking, oh, Gucci stands behind this product? This is a brand, this is a product that Gucci has put into the stream of commerce. Or are you seeing Gucci as part of this real Gucci, a commentary on all these other different things that bring in Gucci as a producer of bags, but don't necessarily point to Gucci as the source of that tangible product? And as you know, as you say in your article on trademarks and digital goods, when content becomes product, so when all these questions are not anymore in the physical world, but are translated into the metaverse where we're only seeing images of things, you know, yeah, that all these questions about, well, what does that use mean? And what is the message I'm actually receiving from that digital object? And what do I actually care about? Which is also another point you make in your trademarks and digital goods article. You know, what exactly does the consumer care about in that space? And it seems as though, as we're in the middle of all this confusion, individuals, especially those that are producing things for the market or just, you know, creating an artistic work. Like now I think of someone who is in Maison Rothschild position, will actually try to seek permission as a way to avoid litigation. One thing that really struck me when I saw the House of Gucci movie was I stayed, you know, like the nerd that I am, I stayed to read all the credits. And I saw that, you know, the end credits read that the GG mark that appears in the title, so going back to the Fred and Ginger Rogers idea, was, you know, used with permission of Gucci. But Gucci at that time, you know, did not have a mark for entertainment services, including the production of film. You know, you could make the same argument as in the Ginger Rogers, the Rogers case, that, well, this is part of a title. So, you know, it's expressive, and part of an expressive work is film. So do you see that? I mean, especially in, you know, in your practice, I mean, do you see that perhaps we're erring on giving brands, you know, more trademark rights because we're just not thinking about challenging this idea of what is a trademark use in practice? And, you know, what actually do we mean when we say source, and what are we actually fighting about in terms of confusion?
Yeah. So this is a great set of questions. So first of all, I think there's no question that the risk of chilling effect is really significant here. I think it's a significant anytime that you're dealing with uses that have speech characteristics, and there's not a clear doctrine that the defendant can call on early in the case to get out of it. If it requires lots of development of survey evidence, if it requires a trial, that's going to have a huge sort of chilling effect, right? So I want to use an analogy to sort of get at the question you're asking about House of Gucci, because I think this is kind of an important point, which is, I work in LA now, people ask all the time about this idea of life rights, right? Like if somebody, I want to sell somebody the right to make a movie about me. And I always say, like, life rights is not a legal rule. Like there's no such thing as life rights in that respect. What it is more like a covenant not to sue, and maybe an agreement to cooperate, right? So if I want to make a movie, a documentary movie, or even a fictional movie about a real person, I don't need their permission, right? That's a First Amendment protected activity. And so I can do that, and I can call it something that's related to that person. I don't need their participation. They can't sue me for that unless it's like defamation and there's like, you know, it meets that very high standard. That doesn't mean there's not sometimes value in actually getting the family to work with you, right? Or because A, they might have access to information that you wouldn't on your own, right? There might be things that they can deliver to the movie that make it better, right? Make it more interesting. And also, like, it might be valuable to you in marketing to be able to say, like, this is an officially collaborative thing and the family helps you promote it, right? And they work together with you. So, but none of that requires there to be a trademark right or any other right that allows people to prevent you from doing it, right? Usually collaborations are valuable in part because people announce that they are collaborations, right? They want to, and when there's a collaboration, they want people to know it. Right. And if you have a rule that basically says you can't lie about that, right? You can't tell people it's a collaboration if it's not, right? That's the explicitly misleading thing. And you don't need to worry about these sort of like, do people kind of like infer, because there's like people who want to tell you that it's a collaboration are not going to ask you to infer it. They're going to beat you over the head with it, right? And they're going to tell you this is a collaboration with this artist. So I don't know any of the details of the House of Gucci story, I'm speculating a little bit here that one thing that could be happening there is just Gucci doesn't have a right to stop them from making a movie called The House of Gucci or to reference it, but working with Gucci might have gotten them access to certain kinds of archival information. It might have gotten them access to certain kinds of, you know, stories about the family members. It might have gotten them things that they wanted to put in the movie. So there might have been value to them in collaborating officially and saying so, even if they didn't have a right to prevent them from doing that, right? And so I think it's like, this idea that unless you give people the exclusive right, like to not, you know, to prevent that, there's then no value left, I think it's just wrong. Like it's just demonstrably wrong. So your first example you used was, you know, if there's a collaboration between some luxury handbag maker and an artist, and they're making physical bags, right? They're making physical handbags. That's a pretty conventional trademark story, right? That's like, I'm producing a bag. If people are confused about who's working, who's collaborated on that bag, that's a pretty easy, straightforward trademark case. Although I kind of strongly suspect in those cases, not all of them, Jeannie and Amy have some interesting stories about sort of hidden collaborations, but those are unusual, I think. I think usually when people are collaborating with a famous artist, they want people to know that. And so they don't hide it. But it gets harder when you reverse the example, right? When it becomes Nike collaborating with an artist who's then making what you would otherwise recognize as conventional art, right? Not selling handbags, but paintings or sculptures or things like that. And there, I think, like the analogy to the Life Rights movie thing is quite good, right? It's like those are pieces of art. They shouldn't be stuff encumbered by trademark rights. We shouldn't have to get permission to do that. That doesn't stop people from getting permission if it sometimes gives them some other value. It just means then the way that they're going to market that is by announcing something, and we'll just sort of police the truth or falsity of those statements.
I will say, I think that you're on point for the House of Gucci, because they did get access to the Gucci archives for Lady Gaga's costume. So
there you go. Right.
Yeah, so at least, I mean, just saying, going and saying, you know, we're making this movie, and can we at least, you know, use the GG as part of the title, even though technically you can't stop us from doing it? It gets us other things, right, which is really good. I just want to return, because we are talking about digital fashion, and you know, we've talked a little bit about heritage, to this idea of, you know, when should digital fashion, and I might even say like digital fashion heritage. I think, for example, of the Armani Silos archive that's now digitized, you know, with Armani's drawings and everything, and accessible in Milan. When should those things count as goods for Lanham Act purposes? I mean, you say a little bit about this in your article, but I think it's worth ending on this note.
So I guess I'm interested in saying a little bit more about, like, when you say are these things, like, what? So I guess I want to know a little bit more about, like, the kind of uses that you have in mind that might be challenged by somebody else. Like, what is?
Sure. So, I mean, I like in my own work, I think a lot about how we have these archival fashion, and, you know, many fashion publications have reported on this, but a lot of archival fashion has changed the way we dress. So in other words, instead of walking into an Armani store and saying, oh, okay, I want, you know, what you have on the rack, people source dresses from vintage stores, or, you know, they source from, you know, other online platforms. But brands are increasingly taking advantage of that our interest in archival by reissuing dresses and products from their archives. And sometimes these things have IP rights attached to them, because, you know, they have a logo that's been in use for a continuous period of time. But at other times, they're just new things that are put on the market that have not been, you know, in its channels. And so, you know, I can imagine, for example, like Valentino or even Armani taking something that's been digitized in a digital archive, and so shown as, right, going back to your point about the image, and kind of placing it in a space where it's for sale, or, you know, it's can be worn, right, on your avatar. So, I mean, there, that's a lot like the first example you gave, where it's an image, and so what do we care about?
What I think it should do is, like, let us sort into two different legal regimes, right? And to say, if what we're talking about is a digitized image of something else, the image might have some copyright associated with it. Some of that's going to depend on whether the thing that's depicted is still the subject of any kind of design rights or copyright. You know, anything that I would regard as genuinely vintage or archival should be too old to have any IP rights associated with it anymore. But, you know, if copyright attaches, which, you know, the settled rules in the United States, at least prior to Star Athletica, would have said most most stuff that, if we're just talking about cut and shape and stuff, wouldn't have been subject to copyright protection. So best case scenario would have had design patents, which should have expired, right? But then it gets more complicated if you start talking about things that have logos and other kinds of things incorporated into them. But, you know, but if you're talking about just like taking a digital image of something old and incorporating it into some digital environment, I would say that's a job for copyright law. We could sort of sort through what copyright exists there, how much is it like a photograph versus something else, and what underlying rights there are. But I think it's, you know, the first thing you were talking about was like, you know, taking vintage images and then actually using them to produce new physical goods, right? And there I would say, you know, there's the sort of conventional IP question, which is, are the new physical goods in some way infringing of copyright or design rights in any of the prior ones? If not, then I think the it's more of a trademark question, right? It's more of, and that's really about, I would say, the positioning of the logos and things like that. There are lots of design companies in the world that have tried to bootstrap old design rights into trademark rights for the shape and configuration of things. Furniture companies are especially notorious for that, but I think sometimes fashion designers too. You know, I would think, given the existing rules, it should be very hard to do that with an old design, because the secondary meaning rules should require it to be pretty well known. And I suspect if it's really archival, it's probably not, if they haven't been using it for a long time. But you know, that's a nice exam question for my design law class next semester.
I'm honored. Thank you.
Yeah. I think you were in the very first design law class, right?
Yes. Yes. I was in, I think, one of your first, yes, design law classes. Yeah. It's, I mean, you know, it took me on this path. So thank you on many different levels for that. I remember you telling me, though, that we'd be looking more at athletic shoes than luxury shoes as a disclaimer for one of the first classes. So.
Well, you know, at the time, at that time, I think this is still probably mostly true, but a much closer question. At that time, athletic shoe companies were heavy users of the design patent system, and fashion companies were not. But that's shifted some. The fashion companies have made much heavier use of design patents in the last decade.
Mark, thank you so much. This has been so exciting and so great. And as always, when I talk to you, I've learned so much. So thank you.
Thanks for having me. It's a lot of fun.
Speaking to Mark highlighted how porous the divide between commerce and culture and intangible and tangible products seems to be today, as brands litigate trademark infringement and dilution cases, especially in the digital space, and seek to blur the divide between what is in the province of copyright and what is in the province of trademark. Is creating a work of authorship with the image of a trademark in the metaverse, for example, a trademark use? Is creating a digital expressive image of a Birkin that necessarily shows the design of the Birkin bag a trademark use of the design of the Birkin bag? Be sure to watch this space between commerce and culture in digital fashion, because there are a number of cases being litigated right now, including the Meta Birkin's appeal and the Mischief and Van case, that will further outline what types of creative expressions, if any, are relevant in trademark law. And perhaps even more importantly, how they might be relevant. Digital goods, or as we might say following our conversation with Mark McKenna, images of goods, are not the only thing to concern ourselves with in digital fashion. AI is increasingly having a moment, perhaps more so than NFTs, as just one example. To explore what might be next on the digital fashion horizon, I thought I might travel to Milan to speak with a partner at the law firm DLA Piper and a fashion law specialist herself, Elena Varese. So you're a partner at DLA Piper in Milan, and you're also the co-head of DLA Piper's consumer goods, food, and retail sector in Italy. What trends do you see now in fashion and luxury in the digital space? I know how active you are in Milan and the articles you've written too. You know, what trends do you see not in the production of physical tangible goods, but really in the production, sale, and creation of digital goods, NFTs, and of course, I'm thinking of metaverse offerings.
Basically, I see now fashion brands like copyright and content creators mainly. like publishers. So they needed to adapt to this new environment and to the new needs of consumers, especially after the pandemic. So NFT was a big trend, of course, you mentioned it. I see that perhaps, generally speaking, the brands, not only the fashion brands, that were actually very quick in embracing this new trend, did not exploit the full potential of the technology. Basically, they offered NFTs are as, let's say, digital works, digital copyrighted works for special creations and capsule collection, let's say. But there's much more to that. And I think this has not been fully exploited. So I would say that perhaps the future of NFT, which perhaps is reducing the hype right now, is to provide utility tokens, i.e. experiences, rather than copyrighted contents. And this makes them more exclusive, more personal to the customer that, of course, would like to have, let's say, again, a personalized, a customized experience. And perhaps also the authenticity key and technology underpinning NFTs shall be considered by brands also for increasing traceability of the items or to show mainly ownership certificates of certain creations. And this, of course, overlaps with art and not only with fashion. So this is super interesting. That's the first trend. Of course, we cannot not think about artificial intelligence. The brands are very cautious. I mean, there's a lot going on in the EU and the US. There are the first litigations on generative AI systems. And fashion companies are trying to regulate artificial intelligence on the one hand internally, because it's, of course, it's an accelerator of creativity. On the other hand, of course, they would like to prevent infringement proceedings by using that technology. And of course, they would like also to prevent the scraping of their own archives, their own contents from their websites or their own, let's say, media, let's say. So these are the two main trends I see. Of course, we could mention also virtual fashion shows, augmented reality, but the main two I see for the technology are NFTs, perhaps in a new version, and artificial intelligence.
Experience and authenticity are two. I mean, especially authenticity is such a key word in the fashion and luxury industry. And of course, you know, AI. But these, you know, two or three things you mentioned also bring up how you categorize these types of notions and concepts and words and new innovative technologies that are not, you know, necessarily already considered to be like an IP, right? So I think a lot about how fashion and luxury brands, you know, use authenticity, but then they buttress authenticity with trademark rights, especially. And of course, you know, AI now we're talking about how AI relates to copyright. Could you just tell me, I mean, how do you see, especially from your EU legal perspective, how do you see these types of new trends and new activities? How do you see this range and the two trends that you mentioned mapping onto the IP rights we recognize, so trademark and copyright especially, and how is AI, you know, disrupting some of these categories?
Generally speaking, the way you exploit and you create these different contents are mainly license and service agreements. And these license and service agreements pertain to different IP rights. There is basically a trademark license over the creation of, over the use, first of all, of the trademark of the brand in the digital space. And then perhaps there's also a license of pre-existing copyrighted contents of the brand to make new creations, incorporating both such, let's say, background IP copyright creations and the brand into a new creation. So it's a little bit of an exchange of rights, but I think the two mains are copyright and trademark. They could overlap. Of course, we think about trademark and copyright as two different IP rights. And just, of course, to mention, of course, trademarks are indicators of origin, whilst copyright protect the creative effort. As in the reality, there could be overlaps, And this is all the more true for the digital world, I would say, because perhaps also a digital fashion creation embedding a trademark and a pattern could be protected both as copyrighted work because somebody created it also throughout the software or automated means, but also it could be a trademark because it's bearing the brand. And if there's a pattern, depending on the circumstances, in the EU, we have design rights that also protect bidimensional aspects of a product. And if the pattern is distinctive, it could also be a trademark itself. So it's really boxes of boxes and different instances of IP rights that are basically converging and overlapping under the same item and on the same object. This happens anyway also in the real world, because if you think about shapes, if they're distinctive, they could be trademarks. If they have artistic value, we do have artistic value in Italy for copyright, at least at in law, we will see for the future. It could be copyrighted, but also if they are new and have individual character, they can be designs. And the same translates into the digital world. And it's actually even worse because the boundaries are of course, blurred, I would say. So this is how I see it. I also see that IE adds a further layer of complexity to the overall issue we were discussing, because of course IE creations are eligible for copyright protection also under the EU law. There are precedents also in Italy. We got something about a decision of the Supreme Court of last year that pertained to automated creation throughout a software, where the creator is not about AI, but the principles apply also to AI, basically where the user could operate throughout his own discretion and selection, the software, therefore the output is creative and is provided with originality. Therefore, IE creations are eligible for a copyright protection as far as you could show that the machine, the computer, did not act on its own without intervention of the human, because of course creations can only be of the humans. So, no question on eligibility of AI powered creations as far as you could evidence the creative process behind them and the discretion, the skill and labor, and the discretion of the author in assembling, let's say, and in making the creation. So evidence is very important in that sense.
It's fascinating the overlap you mention, because indeed, if you think about AI like a software, you know, I mean, think about how we all write things on Word, you know, for example, I mean, that's no less eligible for a copyright just because we use our computer. So, yes. I mean, the new questions and the new reasoning that's being required as these new technologies come into play is really fascinating. So thank you for highlighting that. I guess we've talked a little bit, and you've mentioned about, you know, how our archives are really, you know, kept in-house too because of the scraping, right, element if they're digital. And of course, you know, we can think of so many examples of how tangible garments are now from archives are now worn on the red carpet. And we can see how that could easily happen if there's a digital fashion show, for example, and someone takes, a designer takes a sketch from that's been digitized for the archive and just, you know, places it on a virtual model. And so that brings me to fashion shows. And I know you've written on, you know, the IP protections for fashion shows. And you mentioned a little bit, I think I just want to call out to those who are listening, some differences too that are really fascinating between jurisdiction, the US jurisdiction and other jurisdictions. So you mentioned artistic value, for example. That's an addition for designs that we don't have in the United States. Under copyright law in Italy, designs of industrial articles can also be eligible separately from design rights for copyright if they have this creative character and an additional artistic value. And also Italian copyright doesn't require fixation, whereas U.S. copyright law does. So this stratification that you mentioned at the beginning, you know, becomes a whirlwind. We're kind of in the eye of the storm, if you will.
So true.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about fashion shows. So could you tell us a little bit about, you know, how fashion shows can benefit from IP rights, and how, you know, how do you counsel your clients when they're putting on a fashion show about, you know, what's protectable? I mean, what they can, you know, claim, as it were, versus what they can't.
Yeah. Well, here there's a lot of flexibility, I would say, because as we have no fixation, of course, I mean, you might have a whole concept of a fashion show. But of course, since you could also have copyright infringement, whether in case certain parts of the work has been copied, you could claim copyright infringement, even if only parts of the fashion show have been copied. I would say the suggestion is mainly, it's very simple, and it's only on the evidentiary side of things, is to make a sort of plot of how, and perhaps some sketches on how the fashion show works, how it assembles the different creations, and what is the intervention of the models, which style, the music, and the different work of art that are included, work of art or design items that are included on top of the fashion creations, of course. So an overall document explaining how the different parts interoperate is surely helpful. But of course, we have no fixation requirement. Most of the fashion shows are filmed, and although we don't have a fixation requirement, proof of copying shall be given throughout the plot, and also, let's say, the screen and let's say the film, the movie that includes the fashion show. So I must say, there are not many cases of infringement and copy of fashion shows. You could really say whether certain little features have been, let's say, transposed or copied or included in other fashion shows, but it's something that's really doesn't go beyond, generally speaking, the mere inclusion of single elements. So it would be easier to me, rather than protecting the whole fashion show, that is one of a shot, basically one of a kind, you have it for one day and then it's over, it's really, you know, fading away very quickly, it's easier to protect certain elements with regard to fashion shows.
It shows two things. The first is, even though you might theoretically think that there's, you know, a broader scope of copyright because of lack of fixation, evidence, right, still basically gets you practically in
the same direction.
Exactly.
Same results.
Right. What you have in the U.S. from a theoretical standpoint. And then it also is just another example of how, going back to what you said at the beginning of authenticity, even if a fashion show is at one moment in time and still benefits from, you know, a very narrow copyright, if it has copyright at all, archiving the fashion show and then showing it and showing the video over and over again in a store, for example, can get you that level of authenticity that is outside of the IP regime. So the way in which, you know, negative spaces of IP, you know, to quote the famous article by Sprigman and Rastaglia, work, you know, in conjunction with IP rights is really fascinating to think about in the fashion and luxury space. So my last question to you would be, you know, what aspects of IP do you wish fashion brands might more fully appreciate as they, you know, enter the metaverse, create these new experiences, embrace AI, and, you know, police their IP rights? I mean, I'm thinking especially of, you know, fashion lawyers who might have a client come into their office and say, look, I want a show in Italy, you know, and I want to do this, and I want to do something interesting in Italy. You know, what should I think about? Or even, you know, law students who are interested in the differences in the jurisdiction and have found this conversation super illuminating. I mean, is there something in your practice that you feel like people should really know about, like an area that they don't fully appreciate yet?
Well, I would say that the key word here is to have an holistic IP strategy and holistic IP approach. Of course, you don't need to know only IP laws regarding protection of your own creation, because here we are in the digital space. We are in something that is that goes beyond the boundaries of the different jurisdictions. So I think both, let's say, fashion lawyers and the fashion brands should embrace also different kind of laws that sometimes are set aside. Our code of cultural heritage ones, just to name one, and similar legislations that are around the EU. Here there is a debate because, of course, there's no, let's say, harmonized law regarding use of cultural heritage. We do have one, but different, let's say, member states don't have any, and they have a freedom of panorama. We don't. That's one. And of course, embrace also AI, regulation of technology, and how things work in practice. Because if you don't understand technically how things are working, it's difficult to provide sensible advice. So the tech barrier, I think, is something that shall be, let's say, overcome, because otherwise you cannot really provide meaningful indication or advice to your own clients, or you cannot ultimately serve good your own brand. So these are the two main takeaways I would recommend.
Elena's great overview of how copyright and trademark law and even design rights are mapping on to fashion and new technologies like AI, especially in Europe, touched on how stratified and layered and related IP rights might be in fashion and practice, no matter our perhaps innate desire to categorize these IP rights into different categories. Contracts can also provide an avenue to essentially create an architecture of these IP rights, pointing to different standards in different jurisdictions and countries, like artistic value for designs in Italian copyright law, which Elena mentioned. But contracts are not just the province of digital fashion and this new Wild West, we might say, of the scope of IP rights in the face of new technologies and new digital iterations of fashion, including those generated by AI. Contracts can also apply to fashion shows, which we discussed with Elena, whether these fashion shows are in the digital sphere or in the tangible world, or both in some hybrid form. In fact, Elena also mentioned another legal framework that you might not have first thought of when considering how to take a holistic view of fashion in the digital space, Italy's Cultural Heritage Code. Have you seen fashion shows in treasured spaces of cultural heritage lately, for example? Maybe in your favorite piazza or even your favorite museum? If so, you probably watch these shows on YouTube or on the brand's website. But the question might have arisen in your mind: how do these fashion shows take place in these spaces of cultural heritage? Are there unique legal considerations when a fashion show is filmed, for example, in a cultural heritage space, like a piazza or historic city center? What makes a good partnership between a cultural institution and a fashion brand, whether that's in the digital space or in our tangible world? At the next Fashion Law Dinner Party, we'll explore these questions as applied to some relatively scandalous case studies, like Kim Kardashian's wearing Marilyn Monroe's dress on the Met Gala red carpet a few years ago, and some other, more tame and decorous examples, like Ferragamo restoring Neptune's fountain. So join me as a guest when I speak with Valerie Steele, the director of the Museum at FIT, with Sarah Scaturro, the Eric and Jane Nord Chief Conservator at the Cleveland Museum of Art, and with Giuseppe Abbattista, the Group Tax Consultant at Salvatore Ferragamo in Florence.